So can we just agree from here? No drama, no stress.
This is The Extra Hot Grade Podcast, episode 344 for the week of March 1st, 2021. I am helpful paper map gift in 2021, David T. Cole, and I'm here with butt bow, Sarah D. Bunting.
Comes with six butt arrows.
S-A-H-M with an M-L-M, Tara Ariano.
Try the booty blaster shake.
And unseemly usher, Brandon.
Let me show you to your doom.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us once again is Brandon. Hello, Brandon.
Brandon.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. No, thank you for having me back.
Yay! We're so thrilled that you're here to talk about another Lifetime movie. Before we get to that, though, briefly, we just want to say, little site business up top, please, your Canon and Nonak submissions, give them to us. We need them. After this week, the cupboard is bare. So go to extrahotgrate.com, click that info hub button up top, and then from there you can get to the submission instructions that will tell you exactly what you need to do. So yeah, if you've got one that's been on your mind, on your heart, now is the time.
And we'll put a direct link in the show notes as well. So no excuse. Yes. Hit us.
Thank you, Sarah. All right, now to today's topic, Brutal Bridesmaids, a Lifetime Movie Network original, which premiered this weekend. Here's the synopsis by me. After dating for a year, Michael has just proposed to Jessica. And if she knocked what he says was the placeholder engagement ring into a pond immediately, no one should worry too much that that's a bad omen, probably. Because Michael is just about to take a new job that will relocate them from Florida to San Diego, they need to throw their wedding together in a big hurry, which means a lot of meetings for Jessica and her bridal court, Melanie, the roommate she's abandoning, Kristen, whom Jessica was going to start a business with, but now that's off the table, Binky, Jessica's childhood friend turned frequently drunk and inappropriate reality TV star, Holly, formerly Jessica's college roommate and now the tight-assed mother of four, and Sloane, who just had her own wedding fall apart when she caught the groom screwing one of her bridesmaids. And if it sounds to you like any one of these broads has a reason to sabotage Jessica's big day, then it won't surprise you to learn that catastrophes start befalling people almost immediately. Allergic reactions, food poisoning, and even a physical attack on the groom by a strangely small assailant in a cape. But who's behind it? It's a movie. We're going to spoil it, including possibly the end. Let us go around and let our listeners know, should they watch this? Brandon, should our listeners watch Brutal Bridesmaids?
I'm going to have to give you a thumbs down, Tara. I don't think it's worth the viewer's time.
All right. We'll get into the details of that. Sarah.
Yeah, no. I mean, I found things to like, but they were all things that were bad. Yeah. And overall, I can't really recommend it in the traditional sense. So, yeah, it's a no for me as well.
Dave.
They certainly had the bridesmaids, but I don't think it was brutal enough. I wanted more out of Brutal Bridesmaids. So I'm going to have to give this a thumbs down as well.
I have to agree. Backbiting bridesmaids might have been more accurate. They were not brutal enough. So I think we are all
That would also be my criticism. Yes, that would also be my criticism.
Yeah, that's my first question. Like, when you give a movie a title like this, I really expect a lot more brutality, you know. This really let us all down, it sounds like.
Can I just set up where my disappointment started, which is there at the start of the movie, near the start of the movie, there is an opening scene that is the flash forward to like the bride on the beach getting doused, which what I thought was gasoline, which was like, whoa, this movie's going for it. But then at
Me
the
too.
End, you find out it's just like champagne or something and she's going to drag her into the ocean and drown her or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like getting burned alive would be like brutal, really brutal. But we never got there. And it's sort of emblematic of the problems with this, which is, guys, it's 2021. If you say brutal, we need brutal.
Yeah. We need amputations. Yeah. We need defenestrations. We need someone to write this who has ever been around more than one woman at a time. Mm. Just my opinion. And we need someone who knows how to edit a fashion montage. Am I mistaken?
Yeah, no, that was weird.
That seemed real slow. Brandon, what were your feelings about not just the montage, but also an extremely high number of Miami travelogues?
So I actually have feelings on, I inexplicably have feelings on each and every one of those things that you said, even if you meant them in jest. And I will start with the,
I will start with the
say yes to the dress, fashion montage, trying on scene that occurred in the movie, which you would expect from a movie about a wedding, about bridesmaids. They got to have that scene. This may be a personal aesthetic thing to say. They went with the ugliest dress. Well, they didn't go with the ugliest dress, but they sure didn't go with the best dress. They went with some kind of like faux poofy mullet dress where it was normal on top, but then at the bottom it would have like a short skirt in the front with the illusion of a poofy dress. Just real, you know, party in the front, business in the back kind of situation. I was not feeling that. Not the worst by far, which should tell you a lot about the dresses that they had on. Yep. The best that her bridesmaids were not into. They were like, no, that's hideous. I can't imagine you not looking, you know, horrible on your wedding day. And that's when I knew what kind of like criteria we were going by. to the point, you know, I have to echo what David and Tara said. It just wasn't brutal enough.
Yep.
I was expecting bodies dropping left and right.
Yeah.
When they had the sort of flash forward in the beginning, I thought she was being waterboarded or something. And I was like, oh, yeah,
that's good too.
This is going to be brutal. For the first like three fourths of the movie, I would say it's just pranks. At one point, like they get itching powder thrown on them while they're trying on dresses and like someone has an allergic reaction. OK, you know, another time someone gets like what? Like, well, I'm going to say someone gets beat up, but that was her fiance. But there's an intermediate step too where like someone has someone gets like a laxative put in some sort of shake and they have diarrhea for half a day. And you know, so like things that aren't nice to happen to you, but I wouldn't call them brutal.
Right.
And then her fiance gets beat up and you think, okay, it's gonna escalate this despite the fact that there's maybe like 20 minutes left. And it doesn't really. So not brutal at all. And to the like whole whodunit aspect of the movie, it's just full of red herrings. It's, I would say it's almost impossible to figure out who's doing it. And then when the big reveal happens, you're like, oh, I guess that one of the bridesmaids, one of the brutal bridesmaids.
Oh, really? We guessed right.
We guessed right.
It's also sort of like, it doesn't matter. They could have filmed this like Clue, like every day of the week there was a different ending and it would have made as much sense. The one thing that gave it away for me is that she was the slightest actor, and that person running around in the Scream-esque hood and and whatnot like was so I just kind of figured it was that. And she had the only, I thought, the only real true sort of make sense to me motive, which was you know, the business. Part of it.
But then they also were like, and I also was in love with Michael. It's like, since when? Like, yeah, that came out of sense. Nowhere. Yeah. That as
also,
a motivation
him. Like, he's cute, but oh my God, like, talk about give him another take. Like, a lot of the thespionics are not what you'd hope, but also
sure, more like thespiophics.
You're correct. More like thespiophics. But there's one scene early on where like they're doing the scene and they hug and then he has a line and the mic is all muffled and it's like, guys, just do it again. So she's not talking into like your chest. I don't know. I'd also like everyone's thoughts on the stripper at the bachelorette party.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Fourth period phys ed. What? Who? Why?
So I don't want to be that person, but you're picking up what I'm putting out. I must be radiating my criticisms because everything I'm thinking, you're knocking out of the park immediately. I see the stripper and at first I'm like, oh, that's a real cop because that looks like, you know, a real cop, if not like a 46-year-old, like you said it, like, oh, you know, your high school chemistry teacher, if he didn't break bad,
you know, literally, my notes are like fourth period chem.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You would be upset if he showed up to your stripper party. Like if you were having a bachelorette party and he showed up and he took his shirt off, not much in the face, not much in the body, not very tall. You'd be like, what is it? Like, what did they request?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't want to be
That was my theory, is that like they had a real stripper or someone who was like, let's say, with a more traditional male stripper body was cast. And then like on the day he tested positive for COVID or something. And then they were like, so, okay, we'll get someone from the sound department, I guess, like Jeff, come and do it. And
come here, like, Jeff.
He fit the costume. Jeff. So he had to
show us the goods, Jeff.
So I can kind of loop this around to my other critique about it being in Miami, because there is no way this is the hottest male stripper you could find in Miami for your movie.
Are you kidding? No.
But they failed to create even a brutal atmosphere or a slightly sinister one, because it's so brightly lit and tropical that I'm like, oh, this is for sure Miami.
It's like a USA show back in the day. It's like that blue skies.
Yeah. Rayon stockings. Yeah.
Oh, it's like watching Bad Boys 2, and it's like, oh, yeah, I get it. This is Miami, a very nice place, but you're not really, like, amping up the sinister aspect of the, you know, movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of lazy shortcuts. In addition to the stripper, my favorite one was them using B footage that was supposed to be the jilted former bride who had got cheated on at her own wedding. She's driving downtown Miami and she's got European license plates on her car, because they just grab whatever the keywords were: car, downtown, bright lights, boom. Meanwhile, it's like somehow she's been transported to Belgium for like 6 seconds. It was just like a lot of that. And accumulatively, that can often be entertaining, but it just wasn't enough, and it just wasn't dialed high enough to make it like camp worthy. It just sort of fell short of that. So it was like, it was just disappointing. Like, what I wanted was the bridesmaids version of like Rogue One. It's like a total party kill. Everybody at the end of it dies. Like the last two bridesmaids are hugging on the beach and here comes the nuke. And then like, we're done.
I was kind of expecting, like, you know, a similar-ish kind of like sorority meetup, like after 10 years type of movie. That kind of movie exists, right? I'm thinking of specifically the one from that, the Hulu Into the Dark series, New Year, New You, is the one up in my mind. But like, you know, a bunch of girls getting together after a few years, or classmates coming together after a few years to like, you know, do a last man standing because of some, you know, imagined, or rather some grievance real or imagined in the past. That's all over the place. I mean, that happens all the time. And that's what I was expecting going into the movie. And I think that knowing that that is out there, and that, you know, you staff your movie with 7, 8, you know, I'll put it out there, disposable bridesmaids that we could see be, you know, be like the victim of one of the other bridesmaids, and then you don't kind of take advantage of that, then there's just too many people in your movie.
Yeah.
Like, how did you get all these actresses to agree to be in a movie during quarantine? I guess, well, I just kind of explained it myself there.
Well, the part of the problem from a story perspective is that, like, the wedding itself is on such a short timeline that, like, at a certain point, if they did start actually killing people, like, realistically, someone would be like, okay, well, now we can't have the wedding because 4 people died in the last week, you know, like, which in the end, they don't end up having a wedding anyway. But I guess that's part of the reason. But that's also a problem. And the other problem is, like, when you have all of these different potential villains, it's like, have them go into, to again use a pandemic term, have them go into breakout rooms. Like, I want to see them interacting with each other one-on-one. I just felt like we didn't see enough of them, like, having little cliques within the wedding party, because, Sarah, as you know, like, anytime you get a group of more than 6 people together, that's gonna happen. Like, 2 people are gonna go off together and start talking about the other 4. It just, they just are.
Yeah. I mean, I just think they miss so many opportunities. Like, you know, it's not violent enough.
Yeah.
It's not mean enough.
Yep.
It's not funny at all. Mm-hmm. And once they're trying to sell you on the idea that previously jilted bride Sloan is the big bad, which, like, you have watched a movie before, so you know it's not her because it's only halfway through, right?
Yeah.
So it's not her, but then there's all these, like, oh, we're going through the jungle and then we're going to pan into the trees. And then they are, like, trying to create suspense and, like, there's Sloan, quote unquote.
Right.
But why not, like, really go for it and pan way up into a palm tree? And there she is in, like, palm camouflage, including the makeup, tack gear, the, like, stoing, Silence of the Lambs, like, night vision goggles, bow and arrow, speed, like, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And But no, she's just wearing a tank top from Target like yeah. I'm doing. Like, that's not fun. I don't need to watch that.
Yeah.
There was a commercial during this one for another one. I forget the name of it, but it was like, you know, like a crazy carekeeper or something was the premise where.
Right.
And it involved, it seemed like it was their take on Misery. The caretaker gets obsessed with her quarry. And then, you know, there's a scene where she's about to like hacksaw off this guy's arm at the shoulder in order to, I don't know, keep him at home kind of thing.
I've got it. It's called Dangerous Medicine and it premieres on LMN on Friday.
Not bad medicine.
That's a great name.
Dangerous Medicine. That energy is what I wanted out of this one.
Yeah. It was like, no
that,
ruthless
the energy
realtor.
That commercial anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. No, ruthless realtor beats this in a walk. Definitely.
Yeah.
Some of these movies like have huge body counts. Like some of the movies on the Lifetime channel have like kill counts that put Jason Voorhees to shame. Like you like, there are some of these movies where like a person like starts killing and they just don't stop until the end. And like every 5 minutes, it's another kill for any imagined slight that like the coffee person like at the local Starbucks gives them. Mm-hmm. It's like that's just a death. No, they can only execute you once, right? So yeah. They just go for it. And, you know, then you get occasionally there'll just be one with no deaths. And that's a real hard sell.
Yeah.
Like if no one dies in one of these movies, but the, you know, the perpetrator, like, but like the brutal bridesmaid in question, then like, I got to give it a thumbs down. That's probably not worth your time.
It's time to go around the dial. First stop is Tara.
My highbrow is more of a middle brow. Once again, Close Enough. Dave and I talked about the show when the first season premiered last summer on HBO Max, and last week season 2 dropped, also of course on HBO Max. And this is the new animated series from J.G. Quintel, who created Regular Show. This one is about a married couple with a daughter. They share an apartment with another couple who are divorced because they're all kind of broke, and they get into comical situations because, you know, that's how comedies work. And we haven't watched the whole season, but it's so confident and so assured in season 2. And I liked season 1 a lot. Season 2 is really a great leap forward, I think. Dave, would you agree?
Yeah. I don't know if it's that much different. I feel like they bounce between having grounded storylines that are about family and then something really weird happens in sort of the Regular Show-esque weird kind of way.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been solid this season for sure.
So the very first episode starts with Josh, the dad, tossing his daughter Candace up in the air and then catching her and throwing his back out because he has no core strength and being forced to go to the gym. And a hugely swole guy catches him in the alley barfing after he tried to curl like 5 pounds and then brings him to his gym across the street. And we get this. I made a clip.
What we do here isn't just exercise, Josh. It's a church where we max out greatness, annihilate weakness, and discover unrealized swole potential. Weights are my angels, and gains are my God. We're not just blasting bodies, we're blasting lives.
Whoa, you make it sound like a cult.
Thanks! If you do everything I say and devote yourself to the Swole Town system of WADs, workouts of the day, you will get the massive gains you deserve.
I just want to be able to lift up my daughter.
When I'm done with you, you'll be able to kill your daughter.
Brutal bridesmaids too!
I mean, it's definitely better than Brutal Bridesmaids. So there's a story about Emily, the mom, having to look after her shitty old college roommate, this total emotional vampire, when she breaks up with her boyfriend. And I won't spoil where that one goes, but she's voiced by Heidi Gardner from SNL, who's also Dina's nemesis from Superstore. She's great. There's a fracking story with guest voices by Wendy Malick and David Koechner. They did a Scarface spoof involving the daughter selling packets of hot sauce at her preschool. Still really weird, really funny. I'm sure we said this last time, but I think it threads the needle between the extreme absurdity of Regular Show, where it seemed like almost any episode would end with the characters like in space for some reason, and the grounded family comedy of Bob's Burgers. So if that sounds good, try it. Close Enough, HBO Max.
Yeah, it's good.
Then for my lowbrow, Punky Brewster is back for 2021. And the original Punky Brewster kind of feels like it started with the name and like built the rest around it. And this also kind of feels like someone at Universal was like, hey, we still own this. Let's make something with it. And the original Punky, Soleil Moon Frye, is back. Now she is divorced from Travis, who's played by Freddie Prinze Jr. And they have one biological child and then two adopted kids. And Sherry, who was her best friend in the original, still works at the foster home where Punky briefly lived. She's over there shooting, not shooting kids with a gun. She's a photographer, taking pictures of adoptable kids. And she meets one of them who's basically like Punky, the next generation. And of course, surprising no one, she ends up fostering her. Her name is Izzy. So the math does not quite line up. Like, they sort of indicate that Travis and Punky got married because they got pregnant, but they also say they met in the 90s and Hannah is in high school. So whatever. But anyway, the fact that it's on Peacock may make you think it has a new Saved by the Bell sensibility. It very much does not. It's more like in the Fuller House lane. But I can imagine this being nice for families. If it lets Soleil Moon Frye use it as a stepping stone to something else, that would make me happy because she's really good. And the kids are not great, but she's good in her scenes with them. And she and Freddie Prinze Jr. are actually nice together. Like, they have nice chemistry as a axis. So, you know, it's very much what you expect, but not in a bad way.
He got foxy finally to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's cute.
Was it you that I was talking about this with, that he was like good looking, but in this sort of like fatuous, unhormonal way when he was young. And now that he's a silver fox, it's like, oh, here we are.
Yeah, he got a little craggy and it suits him.
Yeah. So cracked are good.
They're nice. So I reviewed it for Primetimer, and that will be in the show notes if you want to check it out.
Any hints of a fridge storyline? Read it.
No, but I will say that Sherry has grown up into a queer lady, and she is dating Jazzica Nicole, aka Astrid from Fringe. So if that is appealing to you, she is in it.
Is it same Sherry, same actor?
Yeah, same.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to Brandon. Brandon, what have you been watching lately?
Well, last week was my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And so I took the day off from doing work to sort of catch up on just basically slacking off generally. Important. And part of that, approved. I decided to like watch a show that had been on my watch list for a while. And I was, you know, very thrilled. It was Search Party, starring Aaliyah Shawkat. Maybe from Arrested Development. You know, the premise of at least the first season is that, you know, Aaliyah's character, Dory, is living the kind of Brooklyn late 20s hipster lifestyle, underemployed, group of friends who are all various versions of like schemers or underemployed like her, and just generally feels alienated and listless. And one day she passes basically just like, you know, a missing poster for someone she casually knew in college. And that sends her off on this path of like crazy stuff. And what I think works so well about the show that I wasn't expecting when it was just on my list as this kind of like black comedy is just how well they were able to merge like the thriller aspect that I love from like, well, horror movies and Lifetime movies with comedy and each individual scene, because they're just able to build this tension that either is going to go towards something incredibly funny or something incredibly like jarring or tense. And you can't quite ever figure out what it's going to be. And I think that adds an extra layer of tension to each, you know, individual moment, which is something I wasn't expecting, that just that particular intertwining of events. However, I would say that since I've binged the entire series in a week, that it probably like only the first season is really like worth the watch, and the show kind of deteriorates from there. Okay. But the first season is really good. Almost enough to justify watching the next four, because each season's only 10 episodes and they're only like 22 minutes in length.
Okay, that's good to hear, because I did watch the first two, and then when season three started, I watched the first couple, and I was sort of like, I kind of tapped out on it, so it sounds like that was the right call.
I felt the same way, and I'm the kind of person who does not mind abandoning a series in the middle. I stopped watching Dexter, like, season four, I think, when he started, like, I saw the first episode where he was trying to be, like, a lumberjack or, like, in a dirty bathroom, stopped watching, and pretended I never saw it. But for me, I think it reminds me at its best moments thematically speaking, of a kind of like millennial liberal version of like a Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there is just this element of disaffection and inability to live up to like a new American dream that I think Breaking Bad captured really well for me at some point. And then this kind of feels like very similar, just from, you know, one is Gen X and the other is just millennials, I would argue.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good way to put it. And for your plug?
Well, for my plug, I'm going to plug my own show because I don't mind promoting myself, because if I don't, who will?
Yep.
Right?
Exactly.
I, of course, am the host slash co-host of a wonderful podcast called The Discourse, which you can find on all major podcasting platforms. So that's just my plug. My plug is me.
Great. Check out the show notes for that.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, a little whiplash here, going from Search Party to Murder Among the Mormons, which actually sounds like a Lifetime movie. Mm-hmm. It isn't. It's a Netflix docuseries from Joe Berlinger, who is like the Ryan Seacrest of executive producing true crime docuseries the last few years. This series, it's three episodes. As you're listening to this, I believe it dropped today on Netflix. This is about a triple pipe bombing in Salt Lake City in 1985. That was a crazy story, but then it turned out that it was like a cover up of forgeries of foundation documents of the Mormon Church that like threw all of this received wisdom and canonical teachings of the LDS into question. And I'd read a book about this case, and it's really like an amazing case. But here's the problem with this series, which was also my issue with Pitch. Hear me out. Both of these things are about Grandpa Bunce subjects that a lot of people are like boring, and then they don't want to deal with it. Pitch was about baseball. This is about like document dealers. Mm-hmm. Rare books.
Yeah, that's extremely your shit.
Provenance. I mean, I'm into it, and I do think there is a way to make it interesting. But if you're going to make a show or a documentary, Jesus, if you're going to make a show or a documentary about this, you have to commit to its being interesting and then make it interesting and not always kind of be undercutting it for viewers who might think it isn't. Like,
right.
Pitch tried not to be about baseball as much as it could, even though that's the entire log line, is this is the first lady pitcher in baseball. Like, great. You're going to have more baseball in it.
Yeah.
This is the same problem. There's like repeated references to what giant nerds documents and ephemera dealers are. And like, I am one now, and it's completely true. But there's like fun processy stuff about how forgeries are done that they don't really get into. There's the fact that this guy was also forging like the first pamphlet printed in the colonies and Mark Twain signatures and all this stuff. And they're like, who knows how many are out there? Like, well, go find out. Like, ask someone. Everyone else is still alive. Like,
yeah.
I mean, don't be like, oh, well, you probably don't care about our series because it's, you know, it's so boring. It's just about document people. And it's like, all right, but don't sell yourself short. So yeah. They really focus on like the bombing investigation, but then you have no idea, or like you have no context for why
right.
These bombings were committed if you don't understand the stakes of the cover up. And those stakes are about like guys making ink out of, tea and Diet Right cola and like making a little bong and like aging paper with it. And I'm like, huh, like that's processy stuff. It's interesting. But then they just have it in a reenactment because they think that people watching Netflix want to see like crime scene photos after a pipe bomb goes off. Like,
yeah,
what is this, Brutal Bridesmaids? I don't need to see that. With that said, it's actually a pretty interesting series, but you might be better off with the book, which is called Salamander. It's purple, and you can buy it at most used bookstores, including,
hey,
here comes the plug, my used bookstore, which is True Crime and Ephemera,
only. That's exhibitbbooks.com. There will be a link to where you can find stuff about various Mormon adjacent crimes. That's the church shenanigans tag at exhibitbbooks.com. And once again, Extra Hot Great listeners, you have a discount code that's Extra Hot 344 to get 15% off your purchase. ExhibitBeBooks.com.
I'm back with the second ever 911 Lone Star report this week on 911 Lone Star TV's greatest show.
Forgery bombing? Tell me more.
So we start off the show with some, you know, domestic bullshit we don't care about. But then we get to the good stuff, which is a wheel well aeroplane stowaway falls mid-flight somewhere in Austin and lands on the ground. But where on the ground does he land? Does he land on a street? No. On an overpass? Nay. Office building? Uh-uh. He lands on a coffin at a graveside service in front of the whole family, smashing the coffin open like, you know, like it was made of balsa wood, which I'm sure it was. And then like the two, now two dead bodies are all like entangled, like some sort of like Pompeii, like frozen in time moment, you know, kind of like their last moment together. And that's how it starts. And the other big set piece for this episode, which I'm going to say had like generally too much stuff about people that weren't in pain. But the other marquee case was a sort of hospital worker that I think was like supposed usually works in pediatrics. You know, they're shuffling him around because they're shorthanded right now because of COVID. So he's wheeling somebody trying to find the room that she's supposed to go in for her MRI. And he doesn't know anything about anything up here in this part of the hospital. So he just absentmindedly wheels her into the MRI room that is in use with this gurney. And the gurney, the magnets in the MRI are so powerful, apparently, that the gurney floats from one side of the room with him trying to stop it. Like he's in between the gurney now and the MRI machine. It takes like 10 seconds to like get pulled to MRI machine. And he gets pinned against the MRI machine halfway up, like in air almost. And they can't enact the failsafe because the failsafe is currently under this guy. It's on the front of the machine where he is now magnetically pinned and being crushed alive.
You left out the best part, which is that everyone has to strip off their uniforms and go in just their underwears, including Gina Torres. So if that is of interest to anyone.
Oh,
yeah, that wasn't bad.
I saw that FYI. Mentioned on Twitter. Thank you for the background.
You're welcome. But they also forgot to mention that there is a person in the MRI tube also trapped in there while this is also going on.
Yeah.
And then when she comes out, she's got like some kind of big metal pin in her neck. And the you know, EMT is like, don't move. And she's like, what? And pulls it out. And of course, like gushing blood everywhere.
Yeah. It's a great show. And unfortunately, next week is the half season finale. Which seems to be setting up some sort of kidnapping, sort of like, we can't take this guy to the hospital because then the cops will get us. So we're going to kidnap this medic squad and now you're going to do our bidding. It's a, you know, it's a trope, but I'm looking forward to see it play out.
Yep.
And that's a 911 Lone Star for this week. That's what I like about Texas. Next on Extra, Extra Hot Great, this week we have adding to Paramount Plus, and then my notes say, get it, because Tara wanted to make sure everybody got her great joke there.
You're
way
welcome.
To go, Tara.
Yeah, thank you.
We are going through Paramount's properties and figuring out what they can turn into a TV series, because that seems to be where the TV landscape is heading. We're just taking properties for every studio that has their own streaming service and turning them into TV shows.
Well, they started it, but we're continuing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So suggestions for Paramount from us there. And then next week on EHG Prime, we welcome back Kim Reed to talk about the real world homecoming New York. So look forward to all that.
Woo.
Coming soon.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from David Ellis Dickerson. It is Mother, May I Sleep with Angel? Of course, I saved this until Brandon came back, because here is the question. You have to take a notable episode of TV and turn it into a Lifetime movie. Give it a title and cast it and change the plot if need be to make it more likely to panic a white lady of a certain age. I will go first. Daphne, Lily Reinhart, is having a great time in her new marriage to Simon Hill Harper. They're having tons of sex, so much that she's not even that bothered that he's sterile and they can never have biological children together, or so he's told her. Everything changes when Daphne's best friend Rose, Jamie Lynn Spears, decides she can no longer keep her promise to Daphne's mother Ruth, Sharon Lawrence, and is finally going to explain to Daphne how babies are made and why Simon always finishes in a blanket or Swiffer wipe or sweater. First, Daphne confronts Ruth and finds out the terrible secret. Ruth had planned to keep Daphne forever in a state of childish dependence so that she would never leave Ruth. That Simon was into Daphne, even given her extreme innocence, was a development no one foresaw and, frankly, is a bit upsetting to everyone. Then Daphne goes home, gets Simon into bed, and at the crucial moment gets on top so he can't do his thing into a nearby takeout container or Amazon box and is pretty sure she's probably pregnant immediately in loads misblown, colon, a husband's messes, or sterile lies. This is my recast of Bridgerton season 1, episode 6, Swish. Sarah.
Oh, God. Scott, Ty Simpkins of Avengers Endgame, and mm-hmm. David, Marcel Ruiz of One Day at a Time, mm-hmm. have been best friends since they were in pre-K, but ever since they got to high school, things have changed. David is their posh Hollywood high school's morning DJ. Scott listens to George Jones. David has an older girlfriend, Donna, heiress Baker of This Is Us. Scott listens to George Jones. But after a whole lot of awkward hectoring by Scott's mom, Alicia Cuthbert, David agrees to put together a surprise party for Scott, things are going okay. We actually see David teaching Scott's cousin how to freak, a moment a generation has waited for decades. Too bad Scott will find his way into a desk drawer he shouldn't and start playing dangerous games with his father's gun in Silent Cake, Deadly Cake. You could also call it Unhappiest Birthday, but Silent Cake, Deadly Cake is right there.
It's very good.
Brandon.
Peggy, portrayed by Sarah Palin, a former vice presidential candidate for the United States of America, and her husband, Hank Thomas Jane from The Punisher and Run, Hide, Shoot, are nervous but ambivalent when they receive a form from their son, Bobby's, played by whoever the actor was who played Beans and Even Stevens. I don't care how old he is. Or perhaps Louis Anderson. Same applies to Louis Anderson. His age. School regarding sexual education course coming up. Mm-hmm. Both parents living in a conservative community of Arlen, Texas, are concerned about exposing their child to such things at the tender young age of 10, but don't think too much about it, just refusing to sign the permission slip. Next week, they find out that the teacher who had been assigned to teach sexual education, having received threats, has backed out. Peggy, substitute teacher of the year, 2 years running, decides to step in to prove that not only can she teach difficult subject matters, but also that a woman's place is in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Upon the news coming out, Bobby begins to be on the receiving end of bullying from his classmates, causing a rift between him and his girlfriend, Connie, portrayed by Kirsten Crook of Smallville, which, if that isn't enough, soon, Peggy starts receiving threatening calls from a gravelly-voiced stranger saying if she chooses to teach the class, it might very well be her last time. Then this is fatal education.
Perfect.
And, of course, that's based on season 1, episode 2 of King of the Hill, Square Peg.
Perfect. Wow. Love it. Wow.
It's, you had me at Palin, really. Oh, my God.
I decided to go the other way. So instead of elevating something in the crazy factor up to a Lifetime movie sort of level, I'm bringing down the Red Wedding from Game of Thrones in order for it to become accessible to a frightened white woman.
Sure.
Pink so it's called, it's called the Pink Wedding because it's not quite so red.
Yeah.
And instead of inviting all the Starks and killing them all, Walter Frey, Kelsey Grammer.
Yes.
forces mm-hmm. Robb Stark to marry his daughter instead, which was the original promise that was broken that led to the Red Wedding.
Right.
And then he's not going to kill them all like the Red Wedding. He's actually just going to force them to live in his mansion, his castle, which is like kind of damp and gross. So that's really bad. Mm-hmm. He's not like a head of a house in this show. He's actually, of course, he runs a marketing company, which is, right, I think is very crucial to the Lifetime movie. Rounding out our cast, Kat Stark is Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yep.
And Robb Stark is the guy who plays Flash in the CW.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Grant Gustin.
And then all the soldiers and footmen and whatnot, all the characters that aren't the main cast at the marketing firm compound mansion castle for Sarah mostly and Kim Reed, they're all stars of MTV reality shows. And that's all what they do. So you got like your Johnny Bananas back there.
I accept.
Yeah, giving hors d'oeuvres and whatnot. So that's the Pink Wedding. Good job, everybody.
Love it.
That sounds great. You know, Grant Gustin is in a Lifetime movie already. It's a classic. It's called A Mother's Nightmare. This is a classic one. It's actually, I would heavily suggest watching if you have not seen it. And I think it is like year before or 2 years before he becomes the Flash. So he looks exactly the same.
Excellent.
Amazing. I'm going to make a note of that for a future forcening.
Same.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon user submission this week. Take it away, Jessica.
Hi, friends. My name is Jessica Leese, and today I'm submitting The Mole, Season 2, Episode 11 for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Back in the summer of 2000, every major network tried to capture a little bit of the same lightning in a bottle that CBS had found with Survivor, and ABC's best effort at the time was this. Like Survivor, it was an adaptation of a European game show. And also like Survivor, it relied on social dynamics and deception as players competed for a gigantic payout. It never did great in the ratings. And in fact, season 2 was yanked off the air mid-season for roughly 6 months. But 18 years later, the original incarnation of the U.S. Mole is still a joy to watch. The slick production, winning cast, creative challenges, and strategic elements are all contributing factors. But credit must also be given to the host, this total rando that ABC plucked from the relative obscurity of their newsroom. His name, Anderson Cooper. I'd never say it's a disappointment that Anderson went back to journalism, but I am mildly bummed that we never got more of him as a reality host. He was exactly the right balance of serious and fun for the genre, but he also took the right amount of sadistic pleasure in messing with the contestants. And he never had more fun in this gig than he did in this, his penultimate episode as Mole host. I submit that his performance alone makes this episode canon-worthy, but the excellent gameplay and likable contestants ensure that every beat of this episode hits its mark. And of course, there's the centerpiece of it all, potentially the weirdest thing a reality contestant's ever been made to do. It's criminal that this season isn't available for streaming and was never released on DVD. I'm guessing it might be related to music licensing for reasons we'll soon discover. So I'm not going to blame you if it hasn't stayed completely fresh in your mind. But if you watched this episode back in 2002 for any length of time, I need only utter the phrase tiny bubbles, and I know you're right back there again. There's a fun interlude up top where the final four contestants ponder the ethics of leaving a box of live worms for restaurant staff to clean up. But let's skip ahead to the main event. Anderson's Funhouse, a strange tchotchke-packed villa somewhere in the Italian countryside where three of the four contestants will be compelled to spend a night. The main thing that makes Anderson's Funhouse special is, of course, Anderson and his Norman Bates-informed description of the setting. Clip one.
Welcome to Anderson's Funhouse. I hope you have as much fun here as I do. My mother built this house for me when I was very small. Do you like my dolls?
Don't look at me like that.
He mentions here that his mother set this place up for him, but come on, Anderson. Gloria Vanderbilt would never. Anyway, this bit he's doing is so ridiculous and weird that he has a hard time getting through it without cracking himself up, but he quickly finds his footing by focusing on the many creepy dolls in the room and spinning off from there. The more times he mentions his girls, the more amazing it gets. And then there's this soundbite, which plays over a close-up of a doll and comes out of absolute nowhere. Clip two.
The rest of you? Well, we have other accommodations for you here in Anderson's Funhouse. Don't be girls.
Stop looking at me like that, you harlot!
Sorry.
There is a point to this nonsense, I promise. Well, most of this nonsense. There's no point to what you just heard. After Bill wins a card game that exempts him from having to spend the night in the house, Al, Dorothy, and Heather are taken to separate torture chambers. If they complete their individual tasks without quitting, $100,000 will be added to the prize money. But if any one of them quits, no money will be added. Dorothy and Heather are given rooms with some pretty standard Fear Factor scenarios, although the addition of pitch blackness is a nice touch. Still, it's nothing like what Anderson has in store for Al. At first, it seems like Al got the best deal: a metal bed frame, a disco ball, and some bubbles. Al has to stay on the bed all night. That's it. Anderson and Al spend a lot of time quibbling about what constitutes being on the bed, which already makes this segment a winner. You would never see Jeff Probst contorting himself to demonstrate all of the possible ways in which someone could be or not be on a bed. You probably wouldn't even see Phil Kogan do it. Once the parameters are set, Al's in for the night with a final goodbye from Anderson. And then the music starts up. 5 solid hours of Don Ho's Tiny Bubbles. Occasionally slowed down, sped up, played backward, etc. Production definitely picked the right song to use here. It's cheesy and harmless on its face, but once it drills into your skull, it alters you. And when you add to this Al's dogged determination to avoid losing money for the pot, it makes this segment television gold. A lesser man would have quit. Not Al. And after a night of zero sleep and constant Don Ho, a clearly traumatized Al is justifiably annoyed to find Dorothy and Heather sleeping comfortably in the living room. And then, of course, he learns that Heather quit her task about 5 minutes in, so he sat through a night of Tiny Bubbles for absolutely nothing. A little bit later on, Anderson wanders back in singing the song, and Al nearly punches him. And then Bill, who is not subjected to Anderson's funhouse, has to interview all 3 of the other players and determine which one of them is telling the truth about their night. When Al describes his ordeal to Bill, Bill assumes this can't possibly be what really happened, much to Al's rage. And then there's one final insult to poor Al's injury. When the players take their test at the end of the episode, Al is the one who's eliminated, or executed, to use the show's lingo. It really could not have gone worse for this dude. So there you have it. Because it is a perfect example of the state of reality TV in the early aughts, because it contains one of the most diabolical challenges ever perpetrated in this genre, and because it showcases Anderson Cooper at his goofy, giddy finest, I respectfully submit The Mole, Season 2, Episode 11, for your consideration. I mean, doesn't poor Al deserve at least that much after all he's been through?
Thank you so much, Jessica. Dave, why don't you start us off?
Very well. I shall make this short and sweet, I do believe. So, in my mind, I always thought of The Mole, and a lot of time has passed since we have watched The Mole. This is an old show now, which is, like, scary to think about. In my mind, this show was like, this is going to sound stupid, but it was like the thinking man Survivor. Like, it was, was a little smarter. It was more puzzly. Mm-hmm. But watching this, I'm like, okay, maybe it wasn't. Maybe I'm just, like, misremembering it, right? Because this seemed as dumb as everything else going on at the time, a la Survivor. Yeah. At all. That's not to say it wasn't entertaining, because it was. But my main takeaway is the Tiny Bubbles moment is brilliant. Mm-hmm. It is really well executed. It is a fun idea, and it is a different take on what would become a kind of boring trope of reality, which is eat this weird shit, or, you know, live in a cage full of bugs, which was another challenge on this show. The rest of this episode, I can kind of leave it on the table. Like, the challenge that leads to who goes into what funhouse room is just like a really boring game of who has the highest card. Like, that is very unimaginative. Certainly that could have been elevated to have some sort of thematic purpose in all this. It was just like they're all sitting around a table. They flip their cards, and whoever gets the high card gets to pick who is eliminated in the end. I think for me, an entertaining episode, but more of a candidate for our extra, extra hot, great Tiny Cannon moment, which is puzzle cannon or challenge cannon or something like that, torture cannon, because the Tiny Bubbles being played in all different ways, backwards, forward, stutter, stop, everything, like, got to me. And that was only like 3 minutes probably of exposure to it. So having it run for 5 hours is evil. I do agree that Anderson Cooper had like a great balance here. You felt like he knew the type of show that he was in and played to it just the right amount, when you look at Jeff Probst, who I believe thinks Survivor is the most important thing in the universe and that he is solely responsible for his success. That's the vibe I get from him and from Anderson Cooper. It's like, we're all going to have fun here. This is dumb and light and goofy. And now I'm going to do my Norman Bates thing. It's a really bad Norman Bates and it sounds super cringy, but it works in the context of the show. So things to like about here, but I find like the real hook is Tiny Bubbles and the rest of the episode doesn't live up to that. So that is my determination.
Okay. Brandon, you chose this from our list of submissions. Why don't you go next?
Well, thank you, Tara. I chose it because I would consider myself, and I don't want to come across as being, you know, having imposter syndrome, but the preeminent scholar of reality television shows.
Okay.
And I'm very familiar with reality TV circa 2001, 2000. You know, that's the time, like the submitter said, that's Survivor, that's Big Brother, that's The Amazing Race.
Mm-hmm. And that's also us as the viewing public being hungry for all of that. Because like at this point in time, we could not get enough of reality TV. It was new enough and different enough that we're like, more.
Absolutely. And you know, if you were around the time and you remember the time, you can probably remember every channel but CBS, which had that sort of trifecta of Big Brother, Survivor, Amazing Race as their brands, like trying their hand at coming up with like the hottest formula. Mm-hmm. Fox was doing it. Obviously, ABC was doing it.
Yep.
For me, and I've heard of The Mole. I had never watched it. This was my first time watching it. And I chose to like give myself a little context by watching the first episode of the season. So I know what was going on. And overall, I would say the show, not for me. The overall, like, I think I agree with David where like, generally speaking, it seems like a mix of all of Big Brother, Survivor and The Amazing Race. You got to go from place to place, do these challenges that are incredibly lengthy and involve a lot of team dynamics, do a lot of voting. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole like drama and figuring it out element and sort of like strategic element there too. There's too much going on. And I think that like the episodes tend to drag on. But again, at the time, people were so hungry for stuff like this, they didn't care. I actually recently went back and rewatched the first season of The Real World. Unwatchable. I would declare it to be like, it's the way it's edited and the way they chose to like tell that story. Like you can, it's so hard to like watch every episode in a coherent fashion. But at the time, you know, that's what people were experimenting. It was the 90s. It was the early 2000s. I can understand that nowadays we just have better storytelling abilities, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, for this particular episode of The Mole, I can see why you'd pick it though, because it is very good.
Yeah.
Like if you were to say what is the best episode of The Mole and someone said this episode, I would believe it because there are elements there that are very funny. There are elements there that are like incredibly unique. And when you talk about the sort of universe of reality TV shows, you're always just looking for like a new challenge to give people, like something to capture people's attention. And I think the haunted house dynamic in Italy or wherever they were at that point was fun. And the fact that it was a sort of a, like a prisoner's dilemma, you don't know if the other people have quit yet. And so that affects how much, you know, you want to do it, I think is great too. But that's all done in the first 20 minutes. And then the rest of the episode is like, you know, I would say that little bit in the middle where you have like a bunch of early 2000s people just trying to figure out who the mole is a little too much for me sometimes with their journals, like their thought process. And like, you know, okay, you know, I get it. This is a reality TV show. So the people you get on the show are not like quite, you know, like the most thoughtful people, but it's like, I don't see, like, it just drags on. So I would say like,
especially like it late in a season when you're down to a few people and they're really stretching out the, like, let's have this fakey conversation while on a hike. Like, let's not, who cares?
That's why I can't watch a lot of the reality TV shows that are all drama based. Like I have a whole theory of reality TV that maps out on a matrices, like one of those like triangle charts. Like, you know, like with like Spellcaster, Warrior, like support thing, but you know, but it's like drama, like skill-based competition, unskilled-based competition. And so for me, this show does a little bit of too much of all of it. Mm. And I can't do pure, like, those Love Island UK shows where it's just, like, all talking about a very forced topic for a long period of time.
Yeah.
You just can't, it just doesn't work for me. Like, that's just too much.
Yeah.
That is really a keen observation, because the parts where they were like being quizzed on the who is the mole, and there's that whole bullshit with the computer that was like really bad, but oh, it God. Made me remember about the Korean reality show The Genius, and that is sort of like, it was all thinking and puzzles in this weird concept that there's sort of this Wizard of Oz guy looking over this whole room, but everything was puzzle based, and although some of them got lost in cultural translation with some of the games they were playing, because it was like, you know, based on traditional board games there and stuff like that. It was really entertaining in a way that was like, you're getting this one thing, which is a whole bunch of team-based puzzles in this sort of escape roomy environment, and have at it. And there's no sort of like, the artifice was limited, you know, in this sort of high concept stuff. And and the parts of the mole that were like gravitating towards that just made me want to, like, let's separate the parts of the mole that Brandon's talking about, and like, let's just watch those shows, whatever the best example of those disciplines are.
Yeah,
it does too much, I think. The conceit of a reality show that's a competition where one of the contestants is fake and like messing with people is a great idea, great core, that you just didn't need all of the superfluous stuff around it, or only one of the superfluous things around it. Because I guess in my head, I thought of the mole as being specifically just the Big Brother part of them, like, in basically a house trying to figure out which of them is the mole.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that they had competitions that were supposed to suss that out via, like, maybe they're sabotaging, maybe now, like, that, there's no way to tell that. Maybe someone sucks. Like, that's just not an effective way of figuring it out. Yeah. I mean,
Sarah.
I agree with everything Dave said. I will also say that that in my experience, like, people who were fans of the mole were really fans of the mole. Like, they don't like get a, you know, creepy look in their eye or anything. But I think that someone who watched the mole at the time and like stuck with it and still sort of misses it as like a more purist competition show, will like have gotten more out of returning to this episode than I got having never watched an episode of The Mole before.
Oh, I thought you did. That's interesting.
No,
we watched it for
but
sure.
But I was struck at how like needlessly Byzantine some of the challenges are in the way of the challenge, which I do still watch, but is like steadily tracking more towards like American Gladiator stuff and trying to get away from, let's say, alcohol based drama that leads to assaults of various kinds, which wise choice. Like, now that they're in season, whatever, 128, it's probably time to grow up. But this, like, I just felt like I didn't quite understand the stakes, and like things are so complicated, and they're, it's like Brandon said, like just take one or two things off in terms of the challenge part of it. But overall, like, this was a pleasant viewing experience, but I think what we are looking at here is a Tiny Cannon experience where, Anderson Cooper, who I think is always pointed to as like this underrated reality host who really did have a sense of humor about himself, which like, given where he is now, is sort of particularly delightful. Because Probst and his chambray shirts like would never, like, absolutely no sense of humor about anything, least of all himself. And then the Tiny Bubbles, like, my notes read interrogation tech, like, That's what that is. This is used at Gitmo, I'm sure. And if it wasn't before, someone watched this and probably used it after that.
Well, this is seer training. Yeah.
The Tiny Bubble segment was more brutal than anything in Brutal Bridesmaids.
And
it was.
I will also, that's so true. I will also add that on top of all the other ignominies suffered by Al, he's evidently a Mets fan. Like, justice for Al.com.
So yeah, I enjoyed this submission, and our esteemed colleague Jessica definitely knows where she speaks with this kind of heritage reality TV or competition reality, but I don't think it's quite like main canon in its entirety.
Yes, as Sarah said, Jessica is our colleague. She used to write for us on previously.tv, and she is a podcaster as well. She's a co-host on Rob Has a Podcast. So hello, Jessica. We will get you on this podcast too.
I think also this submission might be older than her actual child. Like, we've had this one for a while. She can correct us.
Yes. It's so funny, Brandon, that you said you just tried to watch The Real World and found it unwatchable, because I also watched all of season one last weekend, and it was a beautiful experience for me. So I think that might be completely generational, because it was nostalgic. It was not my first time watching it, and I'm a lot older than you. So I definitely have like more of a tender feeling toward it and its flaws as like a document of its time before we knew how to make reality TV. Because you're not wrong. Like, it is very, it's clumsy and weird. And we'll talk about this more when we talk about the reunion series next week. But
so
yeah,
so many pointedly kooky camera angles. So much Comic Sans.
Why? They definitely did not know what they were doing, for sure.
I mean, that being said, though, I find shows like that easy to go back to, because you can just watch it for like, wow, look at what they're wearing.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, people like thought that. And there are some, you know, really the thing about The Real World is that it's a collection of really interesting moments sometimes, but some of the moments aren't as interesting as they wish they were.
Oh, or maybe it didn't turn out to be that.
Yeah. And that, again, I think it's hard to, and nowadays, even think about it as like, but you know, in the early 90s, this is the first reality TV show.
Yeah.
People don't even know how to behave on reality
TV yet.
Yeah. There's no social media even.
Nope.
And so people don't even have that kind of like gene or impulse to like, I'm here to perform for people, unless they're already like a comedian or like a rapper or an actor in some way already. And so part of, I think, what doesn't translate is that like, why are people so weird on camera? I'm on camera all the time. Like, I'm click, 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 click. You know, I'm always on camera. And they're just like, this was one of the most stressful experiences of my entire life. And I'm like, I don't see why that would be.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just it's a relic of its time. You know, a lot of like edits, the editing choices are like wild, but I mean, you know, you take what you get, right?
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, back to this one. It is true. Anderson Cooper is a very watchable host, and him making a meal of his creepy doll guy persona at his funhouse is funny.
It's
amusing to watch. She's right. I definitely did remember as soon as like the tiny bubble started, was like, oh yeah. And when Dave said like this, that just watching it is extremely stressful. It is like the editing on that is very effectively done. Like, you do get a sense, even just watching like the little snippets of it, like the torture that Al really did go through. Mm. But I mean, the other funny thing was that, like, when they're trying to define what being on the bed means, my first thought was like, can you move the bed? Because I watched Taskmaster also. So I was trying to like figure out the ways around it to like cheat.
Right.
Because that's what you do in Taskmaster.
Lawyering it. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. But what I didn't get was like, once Dorothy and Heather are both done, and Heather has basically said like, oh, I quit. Like, Dorothy knows. And then they both go to bed. Like, why didn't they go get Al? Because like by then
they were told not to.
Well, that's mean.
But they could also hear tiny bubbles.
They could.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
maybe they didn't understand the rules either, because I had a hard time with that.
I didn't understand that or a number of other rules. So maybe that's a design flaw.
To answer Dave's point about like this was regarded as like the thinking man survivor, and maybe it's not as smart as we thought it was, for sure true. But speaking as someone who has recently watched The Hustler, which is like the true stupid idiots version of the show, the one with Craig Ferguson. Dave, remember when we watched that?
Oh yeah, right. That's recent too. That's like last.
That's from this year.
Yeah,
where it's like everyone's just playing rounds of trivia, and at the end of this, it's like, "Are you the hustler?" It's like it's truly the dumbest, dumbed down version of this game.
Oh god.
But I've also watched like The Masked Dancer and Cherry's Wild, and premiering next week, Game of Talents on Fox, and like all of these are like, look. look at this clue package and it's like the most witless fucking like show a rebus to a preschooler in Highlights magazine level of like crack this code. Like, yeah, the mole is not smart, but like game shows have definitely gotten stupider since then for sure. So dumb is relative is all I'll say about that.
Yeah, I mean, Wheel of Fortune any day of the week that it's like, I'd like to solve Neppy Christmas. Like, fuck it, guys. Really?
Anyway,
people are dumb.
It's the pressure. And I mean, I think that, you know, again, as a scholar of reality television, that you see a lot of bad decisions when you're like watching people under the clock. But, you know, if you try to judge them too harshly. But I think when the rules are too complicated for the viewer to follow, when they have like all of the, you know, all of the time and patience in the world, it's a little much. For me, I think just overall, maybe not episode specific, but overall to the mole, I think you could have streamlined this entire show down. So
I don't disagree.
You
know,
this might, this might be a deep cut for me as, I mean, for the viewers as a reality television show, like not novice, but like there is a reality television show that came on VH1 around 2010 called Ton of Cash. And the premise of that show was essentially just the same kind of trashy VH1 dating, like, you know, let's say, you know, Rock of Love, Flavor of Love type contestants, or like, you know, are tasked with, you know, as a team of 13 in the beginning, carrying physically a representation of $1 million worth of cash pallets for all the way from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. And that happens across various obstacle courses. Like, it's not literally across the 2,000-mile distance, although it should have been. That was when I first said, I was like, that would, that's another option. But there were just like obstacle courses along each individual path, kind of like the mole, right?
Right,
travel a little bit from one place to another. And for me, if you just added the mole element to it, and like had somebody at each obstacle like sabotaging them, because at each obstacle they have to like get the cash from point A to point B, like over a mountain or across like a ravine or something, and any money they lose, they lose for the whole race. And so like if you just had somebody in that element who was like causing you to lose money, that's all you need. Like that's,
no,
like, that's all the mole of cash needed. The
mole of cash. Watch that.
Anyway,
I'd go on that.
One other thing that I will say is that it was very cute when they got to the quiz portion and then the Chyron came up that says you could download the quiz at their website. Like, you couldn't just play the quiz on the website. You had to download
or
it
on
like
their app.
As a PDF and print it and then take it.
Share it with your friends.
Jesus. How long would it take? Anyway.
.bmp.
I agree with everybody else. This episode, especially coming so slow, as Sarah said, like because of how much padding they have to do, like just add another game. Like if there's, I don't need to see people standing around and chatting and trying to like add shit to their little stupid notebooks. Like, I don't care. And there's not enough show to make this sustained for an hour. Like, this could have been a half hour show. Like, from the start, it could have been a half hour show every week. And so it just felt a little overstuffed to me. But I certainly understand why Jessica submitted it. And in terms of its point in the series, like, yes, the tiny bubbles moment is iconic. But like as a whole episode, not really.
Yeah. All right. Let's put this to the official vote. I am going to say no, but still entertaining. Brandon, what say you? Canon worthy or not?
I would say not canon worthy, but if you are a, you know, scholar of reality television, I'm sure this is another, you know, thing that you could reference to impress your friends.
Yeah. Or if you're Dutch, I think you have to love the mole by birthright, because they've been going on there for 22 years and it's still on the air.
Damn.
Yeah.
I
amazing.
Think that if you really like the show, this is probably one of your favorite episodes.
Yeah,
and I think that's important. And
Sarah D. Bundy?
It's a no for me, but yes to Don Ho and Tiny Bubbles as an interrogation device.
Tara Ariano?
No for me as well, but I will get be in touch, Jessica, about having you on a future episode as a guest, for sure.
All right, that means, unfortunately, The Mole, Season 2, Episode 11, The 11th Betrayal. You are hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
and will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, first, I'm just going to honorably mention the Paramount Plus launch because they announced a whole bunch of stuff. I won't go through all of it. I will just say the Frasier revival that has been long teased is finally actually happening. And it's coming from the guy that did the Contempo Frasier Twitter feed. So dreams can come true. Keep putting your little jokes on Twitter and maybe you'll get a job like this someday. You won't. but the real winner is Glow creators Liz Flahive, I'm guessing at that pronunciation, and Carly Mensch, whose anthology series Roar, it's based on a book of short stories by Cecilia Ahern, will be made at Apple TV Plus. And we all are winners because one of the already announced stars of the show is Merritt Weaver, our queen.
Oh, yes.
And loser of the week.
Once again, Joss Whedon, Variety's big report, corroborates Charisma Carpenter's allegations pretty much across the board. And even people who were not commenting or were like, sort of vague booking in their comments, you get the gist. And the gist is that he's a piece of shit.
Speaking about pieces of shit, you know what time it is?
You're welcome. It's game time. Game
time. Tara is now at 3, but Sarah is at 4. Could win it all today. Value guest trailing at 2. Today we are playing It Happened in D.C. from Josh, who earns himself an extra credit. From Josh. Dave is going to read you a crazy thing that happened on one of 4 possible D.C. comic-based live-action TV properties.
Oh, boy.
They are the 66 Adam West Batman,
mm-hmm.
Smallville, Gotham, and collectively the Arrowverse shows, or apparently also called the Flaroverse shows, I learned today. Yeah. So take your pick. Arrow, or if you're a big Flash fan, Flaro.
Does that also include Supergirl? Sorry for the clarification.
It does. I can't tell you it also includes Supergirl. Yes.
Thank you.
For the sake of simplicity and comic timing, he says, at certain points, some characters will be referred to by their popular comic monikers, even if they haven't been technically adopting that name in the show at that point. So Superman could refer to Clark Kent at any point during Smallville, for example. Okay. Mm-hmm. Every question is worth 1 point. No hints, since it's already a 1 out of 4 chance type of game. Steel meal situation, please, Tara Ariana.
Thank you, Dave. Value guests, I'm sorry to say, have 0 steel meals. I have 8 steel meals. Sarah has 7 steel meals.
Jeez, that's a lot of steel meals out there.
Yeah, we haven't had steel meals for the past few games, so they have not been in play. They've been stacking up.
All right, that's how we play it. Are we ready to play It Happened in D.C.?
Yes.
All right, so the pickety who sees is going to go first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, Sarah, Brandon, Tara is our order. We're starting with Sarah D. Bunting.
Good luck, everybody.
These have been ranked in order of easiest to hardest by Josh. Your mileage may vary. Here we go. The Penguin falls in love with the Riddler. Is that from Batman, Smallville, Gotham, or the Arrowverse? The Penguin
Smallville.
Falls in love with the Riddler. Smallville. Incorrect. That's all about Superman.
Steel meal,
Tara.
That's Gotham.
That is Gotham, yes. The Penguin kills the Riddler's girlfriend out of jealous rage. Brandon.
Couldn't get through 2 full episodes of that, so good luck, everybody.
Even with Donald Logue?
I tried, man.
And Ben McKenzie, 2 of your faves.
Yeah.
How are the villains so old if Batman is so young in that? Do they have like some sort of like youth serum?
It's a special cream Batman uses.
The Lazarus Pit.
All right, for Brandon. One of the show's female leads ends up in a love triangle with Jimmy Olsen and Doomsday. Smallville, Gotham, Flaroverse, or Batman?
I'm going to say Flaroverse. I think that's Supergirl.
And Smallville. Oh. That's Chloe.
Yeah. Chloe.
Yeah, well, Chloe.
Should have known.
She had a lot of problems.
We should have known, right?
Here, Tara.
Yep.
One for you.
Yep.
A gorilla kidnaps Barack Obama. a gorilla kidnaps Barack Obama.
I think that's Legends of Tomorrow's The Flareoverse.
Correct. Gorilla Grodd in Legends of Tomorrow.
Probably not the Adam West Batman, but who knows?
Sarah D. Bunting. One of the main villains escapes prison by putting a giant coiled spring under the prison baseball field's pitcher mound and uses it to shoot him over the wall.
I can't imagine anyone in these other shows caring about baseball still. So, Adam West Batman.
You are correct.
Nice.
Back to Brandon. One of the female leads was arrested and convicted for helping run a cruel sex cult, by which I mean the actress in real life was, not the character on the show.
Well, maybe also the character on the show. I never made to the end of the series, but that's Smallville.
That is Smallville, correct.
Yeah, it is.
Tara.
Yep.
A man in a pig mask does a musical number while forcing people to eat pies made out of homeless people.
I think that's Gotham.
You are correct. A more recent Batman villain known as Professor Pig.
Sure.
Jesus.
Sarah D. Bunting. We've now gone from easiest to easy, just to fill you in on difficulty.
Lord. All right.
Author Ernest Hemingway attacks a minotaur. Now, just to remind you, we're not talking about real life events. We're talking about things that happened in DC shows.
Aren't we... oh gosh, attacks a minotaur?
Yeah.
I think that's Flareoverse.
That is correct. Legends of Tomorrow. Today. Brandon, Jimmy Olsen gets addicted to drugs, gets divorced, and then gets murdered. After his death, his never-before-seen bow-tying-wearing younger brother decides to start going by the name Jimmy in his honor. How convenient. What show is that?
Okay.
Jimmy Olsen, drugs, divorce, murdered, and then his replaced younger bow-tie-wearing brother comes in and is now Jimmy.
Brutal bow ties.
I'm going to go with Smallville on that one.
Correct. Nice. That was Henry James Olsen coming back.
Good grief.
It's a little, a little too dark for Supergirl. Supergirl is not the...
Tara.
Yep.
One of the main villains gouges her eye out with a spoon and steps on it on purpose.
I think that's Gotham.
Correct. That's Fish Mooney did it after being captured by a body part harvesting organization.
Right.
Screw you guys. Sarah, one of the main villains kills his step siblings, then cooks them and feeds them to his unknowing stepmother.
That sounds pretty Gotham-y.
You are correct. Nice. That is the Penguin pulling off a reverse Scott Tenorman.
That fucking guy. Jesus.
Back to Brandon. One of the main villains uses a machine to transfer a surfing champion's abilities into himself so he can win a surfing competition.
I'm going to go with Adam West Batman.
You are correct. That was the Joker. He wanted to win a surfing competition so badly. And it's never clear why Batman feels a need to stop him from doing so.
Why wasn't that in the Joker movie? I would like to know.
Jared Leto doesn't have the range for that kind of thing.
Tara.
Yeah.
The heroes are almost eaten by a giant man-eating clam.
Oh, no. That could be either Legends of Tomorrow or Old Batman. I'm going to say Old Batman.
Correct. The Joker does that to Batman and Robin in Batman 66.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. The Joker dies. He is later resurrected from the dead, only to die again. Luckily, before his second and final death, he managed to send a mind control bomb to his identical twin brother, played by the same actor. That turns his brother into the new Joker. All that happened on what show?
I feel like this could be almost any of them. I don't know what show, but I'm going to guess Flareoverse.
Incorrect. That is Gotham.
Fucking Gotham.
Gotham? I would have guessed 66 Batman on that one.
That was my second choice.
That was a real crapshoot, that one.
What is Gotham about? I thought it was about like a kid, like Kid Batman. And like
cannibalism,
some cops.
Apparently.
It's you crazy. Name it, they got it. Gotham's got something for everybody.
People pie.
Who would live there is the real question.
Brandon.
Bugs.
The Riddler spikes Bruce Wayne's drink, and this causes him to perform an elaborate dance.
Well, I mean, if it doesn't involve him also, like, eating somebody, it's probably Adam West Batman.
Correct. That is the origin of the Batuzzi. All right, for Tara, bring us into our mid-game score break.
The yes. Batuzzi.
We are still on easy,
okay,
by the way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jesus.
The Riddler's female henchman infiltrates the hero's base of operation, but clumsily dies when she falls into the nuclear reactor that's in it.
I guess Gotham?
That is Batman 66.
Really?
You know, when wow. Bruce Wayne builds his own Batcave, he doesn't have to worry about OSHA compliance because it's never going to get inspected.
I mean, that happens in Harley Quinn, but I know that's no not friends. In the Flareverse, so.
All right, let's hear the scores, please, Tara.
Okay, very close game. Sarah has 3, Brandon has 4, I have 5.
All right, let's get right back into it. Now moving from easy to easy-ish.
Oh, no.
Will the ish be the difference? Here we go. Okay. Sarah D. Bunting. Yes. The heroes confront George Lucas and tell him that he should go back to film school. Later on, George is interrogated about the location of the Spear of Destiny.
Flareverse.
Correct. That's another Legends of Tomorrow storyline. Brandon? The villain Louis the Lilac has an evil plan that involves using flowers to gain influence with a group of hippies.
What was the name of the villain
Louis
again?
Louis the Lilac.
Louis the Lilac. Hippies. I'm going to say Adam West Batman 66.
Absolutely. Yeah. Correct. That was question 17, by the way.
Could have been Legends of Tomorrow.
Could have. Yeah.
Oh, Tara. Sprite Eagle.
Thank you. A reanimated Genghis Khan tries to conquer Hong Kong with an army that rides on electric scooters.
What the fuck are happening on these shows? Flareverse.
That is another crazy storyline from Legends of Tomorrow. Oh, by the way, Vespa. I forgot to mention Louis the Lilac, played by our good friend Milton Berle
of
90210
fame.
Jesus.
Wow. Okay.
This is question. The zombie villain Solomon Grundy, hates super friends, is reverted back to his human form, only for the person who did it to shoot and kill him in an act of revenge on Grundy's girlfriend.
Gotham
is correct. Penguin did that.
And the Penguin does not like relationships. He goes out of his way to just be.
Yeah,
someone hurt him in his past. It was probably the Riddler.
Back to Brandon. The heroes realize that the demon they're fighting, who is voiced by John Noble, has a voice that sounds exactly like character actor John Noble. So they go visit Noble and have him record dialogue for them that they use to trick the demon's henchmen. Is that Scooby-Doo, Scooby-Doo, or Scooby-Doo? What show is that?
I'm going to say that is Adam West Batman. Legends of Tomorrow.
Flareverse, Legends of Tomorrow. They come to this realization while watching The Lord of the Rings in that show.
Hilarious.
I'm going to be honest with you. Gotham. I watched like maybe 5 episodes of Legend of Tomorrow and I turned it off. That show was not good. but, you know, that's just maybe gets better.
It definitely gets weirder from the pilot, which I watched. That's for sure, judging by these storylines. Tara.
Yeah.
As the heroes prepare for their epic final showdown with the big bad of season 2, another villain character drives up to the scene and just explodes the big bad with a rocket launcher instead.
Oh, man. There's so many that it could be. So I'm going to... Shit. I'm going to say Flareverse. Shit, Smallville.
Penguin on Gotham shows up and explodes Azrael. As one does. We're now in our medium. Medium difficulty.
Medium. Ooh, boy.
Okay.
A villain named the Balloon Man goes around the city attaching people to weather balloons that lift them up into the sky to their doom.
To their doom.
The Balloon Man.
I mean, I don't hear anything about them turning into canapes, so I think that this is going to be Adam West Batman.
What? That's what I would have said.
It sounds like it, but that, in fact, is Gotham.
Shit.
You see them graphically fall back to Earth to their demise.
That was my guess too. I was like, if you had graphically fall back down to Earth, it definitely got them.
Yeah. In a buffet.
Yeah. On a coffin at a funeral.
Yeah, I think in Batman 66 they just would have had oxygen deprivation and gone goofy or something like that.
Right.
And actually die.
He would have had to get in a hot air balloon to rescue them, but in Gotham, the balloon man goes after orphans specifically or something. I don't know.
Or sticks people with pins. I mean, so many options.
How are there any civilians to kill? Because everyone has their own little supervillain alter ego in Gotham.
I think they kidnap people from Metropolis and ship them in or something like that. All right, Brandon, here's your first medium question. In the comics, Deathstroke, a.k.a. Slade Wilson, is a ruthless ninja assassin for hire who has always been popular and formidable villain. For some reason, this TV show instead decided to have him be an out-of-shape 60-year-old something U.S. military general who gives the heroes some bureaucratic grief, and that's it.
I'm going to go with the Flarrowverse.
Smallville. That sounds very exciting.
Good Lord.
Tara.
Yep.
The Penguin brainwashes Alfred into helping him steal millions of dollars from a charity drive.
Old Batman.
Correct. Despite this, Penguin never recognizes Alfred whenever he sees him in later episodes. Sure. Thank you, old television. Sarah. We see a shot of the sky turning to red, and a character played by Burt Ward, who is wearing red and yellow green outfit, looks up at it and says, "Holy crimson skies of death!" Still with us, Sarah?
She's pondering.
In silence. I'm here. I just feel like everything is pointing me towards Adam West Batman, but it is a Penguin-esque trap, so I'm going to say Gotham.
Well, you were thinking right with the trap, but that was a cameo during Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover event in the Flarrowverse.
Fuck!
Brendan. Oops. Bad form, Dave. Lex Luthor's bumbling henchman Otis, who you may remember from the original Superman movie, appears in the show and after many failures gets turned into a cyborg.
I would say Smallville.
You're right on the super thing. That was Supergirl from the Flarrowverse. That story.
Oh, no.
Take us into our second score break near the end of the game for Tara.
Mm-hmm.
Oliver, Oliver Queen, a.k.a. the Green Arrow, is drugged, kidnapped, imprisoned, and tricked into thinking he lost all his money. But at the end of all things, it turns out it was all a ruse set up by the blonde computer nerd that would eventually become his wife.
I think this is a trick. They're trying to make me say Flarrowverse, but it is, in fact, Smallville.
You can't fool Tara here. That was Smallville. Everybody's got two questions left. Let's hear the scores.
Oh, boy. Well, Sarah and Brandon are tied with 5 each, and I have 8.
All right, here we go. Sarah D. Bunting, you've got 1 medium and 1 hard question in your future. Here is your medium difficulty question. Robert Wool, a.k.a. Arliss, reprises his role from the 1989 Tim Burton Batman movie. What was he in that? Was he a reporter?
I think so.
Yeah. He wasn't Arliss in Batman, right? That's not a thing.
That's correct.
Arliss Ching Ching.
All right. Batman, Smallville, Flarrowverse, or whatever the other one is. Gotham.
Flarrowverse.
Correct.
Hey.
Another Total Crisis guess. On Infinite Earths crossover event. I don't know. Robert Wool crossover.
Yeah.
I don't know. Brandon, your medium. The Penguin becomes the mayor and declares that all crime is legal as long as you have a crime license.
I'm going to say Adam West Batman.
You'd think, but that was in fact Gotham.
Wow.
What?
I believe that it sounds like their take on The Purge, kind of.
Yeah.
This just sounds made up. I don't believe this show is real.
In your defense, the Penguin also ran for mayor on Batman 66, but he loses in that version.
He lost. Yeah, now I remember.
Can't fight the machine, even in Gotham.
You can't. You know, America's just not ready for a half man, half penguin to be mayor.
We got a lot of work to do, guys.
Volumes. Was he elected mayor after he had killed everyone's girlfriend or before? Because like, that seems like it would really not sit well with your constituents.
Law and order candidate.
Death to girlfriends.
Anti-wife guy platform.
All right, Tara. Yes. The Riddler makes friends with the River Rat Gang, a group of people who live in the sewer.
Oh, man. Gotham?
That's what I would have guessed, too, but that was Batman 66.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it's never explained why they call themselves that or why they live in the sewer. They just do.
Okay.
Know your place, River Rat Gang.
Sure.
Everybody's last question is a hard difficulty question. We'll start with Sarah D. Bunting. I think these are all as crapshoot as any other. I don't know why we're organizing these by difficulty.
I'll be interested to hear the difference, but go ahead.
The difference is if you actually watch these shows, you would know, and maybe these would be gotchas, but we're all guessing, I think.
Okay.
A main character who left the show in season 3 returns several seasons later in a guest appearance. He now has elasticity powers that he got from chewing magic gum.
Smallville.
Smallville is correct. That was Pete Ross in an embarrassing product placement for Stride Gum. Mmm, Stride Gum. Chew it today.
Good grief.
Brandon, here is your last question. The big bad of season 2 is turned into a zombie who constantly chases after the big bad of season 1.
Okay. The big bad of season 2 is turned into a zombie that is constantly chasing after the big bad of season 1. I'm going to go with Gotham.
That is the Flareverse. On The Flash, Zoom becomes a Speed Force zombie who pursues other dude whose name I'm not going to try to pronounce for his time manipulation.
Okay.
It's simple once you think about it, Brandon. Last question of regulation for Tara.
Yes.
The hero sleeps with his late father's former mistress who now wants to blow up the city.
The Sopranos? Because that kind of happened.
Sarah, not everything can be about the Sopranos.
Can't it?
As much as you try.
Flareverse.
Flareverse, was that your answer?
Yes.
You are correct. That was another Oliver Queen thing. All right, that is regulation. Let's hear the final score.
Very, very close game right to the end. Brandon finished with 5 points. Sarah had 7. I had 9.
All right, well done, we have Tara. One tiebreaker here. We'll read right now. First person to shout out the answer, everybody's in on it, will win a steel meal.
Okay.
Those who do not answer it will lose 3 steel meals.
Oh. Here we go. Penguin.
The main love interest accidentally nukes a whole town. But don't worry, Smallville. She gets over it pretty quickly. Incorrect.
Smallville.
Brandon? Tara?
Gotham.
Old Batman.
Wow, everybody got it wrong. Everybody loses 3 points.
Wait, that you said if we don't answer.
That was not Flareverse. If we answer wrong. Flareverse. I'm altering the deal. Pray I do not alter it any further. That's Felicity and Arrow redirects a nuke. Sarah's giving me the finger.
Two fingers.
Two of them overlapping, doing a dance number. We got Singing in the Rain fingers.
Hashtag.
Rage.
Dictatorship on game time. All right, Tara, congratulations. You win today's game.
Job, Tara.
Doesn't feel that good now.
Tara.
So value guests have like donation meals now? They're -3?
Well, they don't have -3. They're just at still 0. What happened here is you guys just lost 3, and we sort of even the playing field a little bit.
Dick.
Well, that's it for another episode of Extra Hot Great Brackets. Mwahahaha. We picked through the favor bag that was Lifetime Movie Network's Brutal Bridesmaids before going around the dial with stops at Close Enough, Punky Brewster, Search Party, Murder Among the Mormons, and 911 Lodestar. David had us turn an episode of TV into a Lifetime movie, and Jessica's canon case for the Mole's Tiny Bubble episode was eliminated. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Josh. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Josh. Tara and Sarah are both now at the precipice of a season victory. Next up is Paramount Plus Plus on Extra Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHD Prime, it's The Real World. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David Teekle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
you'll be able to kill your daughter.
Sarah minus three Bunting.
I do like shiny things.
And punching Dave.
And our good friend Brandon.
You know, I'm just happy to be invited to the wedding.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Pod Great.
Honestly, I can't wait until next week. You know, we can breathe for a minute.
Yeah.